Welcome to Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. This is the podcast where we explore the people and stories that make up the tech and venture ecosystem. Don't forget to subscribe, like, rate, and share the podcast because it really helps us get the word out to more people who are curious about understanding even more about the world of venture capital. This season of Nothing Ventured is sponsored by Odin. Odin helps angels, VCs, and founders to raise and deploy capital seamlessly. You can structure your SPVs and now run your funds, handle capital calls, portfolio management more smoothly and easily in one place. Founders use Odin to raise their entire round in a few clicks by simply sending investors a link and receiving investments immediately. Odin works with over 5,000 investors and over 150 emerging fund managers and angel syndicates globally. Head to joinodin.com to learn more. That's joinodin.com. Hello and welcome to another episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Mohammed Abu Alam, CEO of Precision Cardiovascular. In today's episode, we talked about managing heart conditions outside of a clinical setting.
If you have a chronic or acute condition, it's very difficult to manage. Precision addresses that by way of data that is transmitted to the doctors in order to inform them better how, as a patient, you're responding to your therapy and thereby taking proactive actions, not just preventative.
Taking tech from the industrial space and translating it into the body.
And it's translated it into the human body. In order to do so, move a technology that is well proven at scale into another arena, you need to have a multidisciplinary team.
The difficulty in quantifying impact to LPs, mixing regulatory with commercial outcomes, moving from investor to chair to CEO, how which side of the table you sit on influences how you think.
When you're at one side of the table, no matter what, the way that you look at things is going to be influenced by others who sit to your left and right.
Looking at the competitive landscape in terms of complementarity and how to keep your team malleable. Let's get straight into it. Welcome to Nothing Ventured. Great to be in the studio today with Mohammed Abu Alam, CEO of Precision Cardiovascular. Mohammed, would be great if you could firstly give us a bit of a breakdown as to what it is that Precision Cardiovascular is actually building.
Certainly. Happy that you have me here today. So Precision is a company in the medical space. It's addressing a key problem that exists with management of heart conditions, which is that once you're out of the hospital or clinic, if you have a chronic or acute condition, it's very difficult to manage. And so as a result, even though the heart is very well understood in clinic and in hospital, the prognosis or the way your health condition develops is very poor once you're out of the loop. Precision addresses that by way of data that is transmitted to the doctors in order to inform them better of how, as a patient, you're responding to your therapy, and thereby taking proactive actions, not just preventative ones.
Okay, so a couple of questions that come out of there for me. One is, you don't have a medical background yourself, if I'm not mistaken, right? So what is it that sort of drove you into this field, which is obviously fairly technical, clinical setting, et cetera? And secondly, Precision itself is a device, right? So yes, you're talking about data, but there is hardware alongside the sort of software and the data that goes alongside it. Finally, I guess one of the questions that I really, really have is, why hasn't this been done before? It feels like, cardiovascular disease is something that has been, well understood for, I think, at least a century. I might be wrong, it may even be longer. Why do you think that something along these lines hasn't been built already, or is that just by nature of the sort of technological shift that we've been going through?
Great. So three questions, quite a lot to cover. Yeah. I'll try and recap them for my own benefit as well. So one is the question about, how
your background not being
my
in medical.
Background, what drove me to it, certainly. Yeah. Thank you. The other one is...
Outside of a clinical setting,
what is missing?
Yeah, well, no. So Precision itself is a hardware device.
The device, the device aspect. Sorry, my memory sometimes.
That's okay.
And then the third one is
why hasn't it been
done before? So I'll try and tie them together also in the interest of time, perhaps. So firstly, what drove me to it was some of the themes I alluded to earlier in my VC investment, which is thematic. So I was actually involved first in Europe and then in the MENA region. Lastly, in the MENA region, and one of the things that was driving the thematic investing there was inequity, mm-hmm. so disparate incomes, etc. And another one was building infrastructure together with your solution. So if you think of those two themes, inequity and building infrastructure with solution, that's kind of what we're doing with Precision sure. here. And that kind of ties into the next part of device and data. So without the device and the outsized performance and economics that are offered by that device, there's no point building data on top. It's economically unfeasible and it won't matter to clinicians. And then lastly, why hasn't this been done before? This is a really interesting question, and I think it ties into a broader aspect underplay of how hard tech is coming back and being looked at. Essentially, Precision is taking something, a technology that exists in the industrial space, and it's translated it into the human body. In order to do so, move a technology that is well-proven at scale into another arena, you need to have a multidisciplinary team.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of what sometimes causes difficulties in very specialist areas, such as medicine, where it's somewhat siloed by nature and not necessarily by design, but over time, perhaps as such as well.
And bureaucracy on top of that.
It gets harder to work on a multidisciplinary front. And that impacts progress, and it impacts fundraising as well, and all sorts of areas. So I think that would explain why it hasn't been done so far. But also, interestingly, the question that VCs often ask, are we in the right place at the right time? That really comes into the fore when you consider why it hasn't been done before.
Mm.
So when you see the need for multidisciplinary teams in certain areas, you realize that even if you're 5-6 years pre-commercialization, there's relevance. The unmet need will only grow, not just exist, but will only grow.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, we had a couple of guests on recently, and they're building in the tech bio space, and a very similar sort of point there that, in terms of teams, they have clinicians, microbiologists, and then they have a very strong data science team, engineering team, etc., because again, it's a tech platform within the bio space. So actually, just to explore that for a second, how do you think about building teams? Because again, you know, often, as you say, a lot of these disciplines are quite siloed, especially in the, probably more so in the medical space, maybe than the engineering space. If you give an engineer a problem, they'll fix a problem. They don't really necessarily care what the problem is, although often, you know, occasionally or often that may well play into it. But how do you bring those two forces together? Like in your mind, you know, how have you been able to build a team of multidisciplinarians around you?
Great. I think as a preface disclaimer, the team was already in place largely before my arrival.
Got it.
So I came to Precision initially as an investor, but it goes back in terms of its research to the early 2000s when biomechanical engineers together with a clinician put their heads together to try and look at particular areas that were unsolved in cardiovascular health management and sought to address that. So there was a multidisciplinary team that predated me and got funded by Wellcome Trust. This is going back a few years.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
But following that, and when we incorporated Precision, what I tend to do is mirroring what I see in our lives today, which is that the impact of AI, while it may be that in the near future we'll see a one-person unicorn or decacorn in certain fields, that's not going to be the case in some other fields, such as medicine, where the human factor is very important. Rather, what's important, and this is the team element, is with knowledge being more accessible thanks to AI, how do you get teams to work together well? So I take the same approach within Precision in that I try to ensure that even for a scientist, he or she has a good understanding of why certain business steps are necessary.
Right.
And vice versa. If we're thinking about finances, the finance people also need to understand why certain innovations need to be protected and progressed at the expense of others.
Yeah.
So getting a bit of a holistic view, in my view, as the team scales up, will facilitate better teamwork and better knowledge.
Yeah, look, that makes a huge amount of sense. And it's that whole thing of being across the whole business, not just being part of one part of the business, right? And I guess you know, finance, certainly, and, you know, from the lens that I look through, that's often the lens that I do look through. Finance has had a habit in the past of being, you know, considered as, you know, the bean counting kind of part of the business, where it's only about, okay, how much you're spending, why you're spending it. Whereas actually, especially in startups, finance needs to look across the whole, you know, the whole strategy of the business, where it's heading and why certain costs today may not make sense today, but will make sense into the longer term. And I guess from a medical perspective, you've got to understand, well, okay, we can't just go off and build something beautiful that we would love to have if there's no commercial application for it, even if it, you know, even if it feels like it would be a great part of the tool. So I think that's really sound sort of advice and thinking around building that multidisciplinary team. It's bringing them all along for the journey, so they're all pulling in the same direction. Similarly, that was very much the conversation that I had with the founders of this TechBio. But moving forward a little bit, right? So you are particularly passionate about mission-driven businesses, especially in the health sector, with a focus on patient well-being. So why do you think it's so important in today's world of, as I said, let's face it, progressively worsening health outcomes due to our lifestyle and other factors? What is it that you know is the driving force, I guess, behind your attitude towards these sort of mission-driven businesses?
So there's one that's personal to me and ties into my investment background prior to Precision. And there's another that's really another theme that's playing out. So investors, and my last work investing in Egypt and across the MENA region, was a fund that had a sustainability adjunct mm-hmm. to its commercial returns as promised to LPs.
So impact-led.
Yes, yeah, okay. Indeed. Sustainability, diversity, etc. We faced certain difficulties in our reporting in order to justify to the LPs how certain investments fit to mandate. I'll give an example, an e-commerce business that had far fewer warehouses than its competitors. Yes, maybe it was very difficult to quantify. It was always a bit of an argument back and forth, a healthy one, but you can see the challenge there. Another one was a mental health platform where a huge number of the psychiatrists were female mm-hmm. And underrepresented otherwise. And again, it was a little bit of a challenge sometimes to justify it. But we got there. In contrast, the world of medicine is slightly different because the entanglement and intertwining of impact-led and commercial-led returns is very evident in mm-hmm. medicine, where you have the classic fee-based model where practitioners offer surgical procedures or consultations for a fee, mm-hmm. the payer being the hospital or the insurer or out of pocket. And then you have the value-based systems where there's some element of a social net afforded by an NHS or other. Mm. So because you're forced to justify as you go to commercialize the reimbursement approach and the regulatory approach associated prior to that, you have to mix the two worlds together. And that drew me to Precision because I hadn't worked in this space before, the mix of the two. Mm. The other aspect is I think we are seeing more and more that medicine is moving from prevention to proactive. So what that means is rather than just a healthy diet and exercise, which we know is ever so important, but over and above that, we're all different. So the exercise and diet that works for me won't work for you. And personalization is really the biggest theme that's going to impact us in our later decades, but certainly the next generation and beyond that. So anything that can assist with the tools, again, this relates to teams, to better offer proactive approaches rather than preventative, is going to help with this paradigm shift or big, big, big leap ahead.
Yeah, so again, this is a topic that I've covered, I think, a couple of times on the podcast, and I think it's interesting. Health and education have similar problems, right? In the way that they are approached, and certainly in the solutions now that people are trying to build, and certainly within education, and I have a little bit of a background in edtech, that sort of personalized model is clearly where we need to be heading towards. And in medicine, even more so, you know, I currently have some sort of health situations going on within my family. And we're very fortunate to have caught those health situations early. And it's only been because, you know, the individual took it upon themselves to get themselves checked up, you know, immediately. Whereas the NHS's broader theme, especially with regards to this specific issue, is after the age of X, 70 or 65 or whatever it is, they stop reminding you to go and get checked out, and therefore most people therefore don't, right? But because this person took, you know, the time to think about their health, they're able to actually solve that, you know, better. But the point is that if you have an umbrella approach, you are always going to miss outliers, and outliers are often, you know, where the bigger problems are, right?
Absolutely. So, and I'll give an example here. The world, which everyone is aware of, diabetes and type 2, etc., there is such a thing as pre-diabetes.
Yeah.
But what perhaps not everyone knows, I didn't until recently actually, is that there's no... It's just a point on a continuum where you move from being pre-diabetic to having type 2 diabetes. It's literally that. And the world of medicine is moving from individual diseases to families of diseases and deciding the appropriate therapy based on where you are on a continuum against your own individualized vital signs. So that's really where things are headed.
Yeah. It's for me, it's interesting. Someone, I'm incredibly interested in my own health. I have, you know, the Whoop and all the other gadgets, I guess. And one of the things that really annoys me is the concept of BMI, right? Body mass index. Because BMI was based, at least as far as I'm aware, was based on sort of, it was extrapolated looking at the data from a group of people who were predominantly, I would suspect, male, white, living in certain areas. And I've always sort of thought about it and said, well, but BMI within like someone like me who's of Indian origins, where typically our statures are slightly lower, we maybe carry fat in different places in our body, it doesn't quite make sense. And actually, you know, what looks like an unhealthy BMI on the BMI scale, actually for me might actually be pretty okay. And actually I'm sort of in the top decile of healthy Indian origin patients, right? So I think, you know, the approach has always been and has been for so long, based on the bell curves, right? Essentially. And there's a great book, The End of Averages, right? Like the reality is that if we're only ever targeting the average, we're missing such a large portion of those outliers and the long tails that sit on both sides. Again, moving forward, you went from strategy at Samsung, then into VC, and then into operating. So why did you believe, or why do you believe that the world of early stage benefits from people moving from different sides of the table to the other?
Great question. So I think the way, when you're at one side of the table, no matter what, the way that you look at things is going to be influenced by others who sit to your left and right, rather than others at the other side of the table. It's almost like negotiations where you say, put yourself in someone else's shoes. My big experience or revelatory moment predates all of this by many years when I started work at Samsung, which was in 2011. Prior to that, I'd visited Asia many times. I went to Samsung in Korea, and I thought that I was well-traveled in Asia.
Mm-hmm.
I'd been to Korea, been to Japan, and many other countries in the Far East and Southeast Asia. And I, in fact, studied at INSEAD in Singapore as well for my MBA.
Mm.
But the big revelation was when I arrived in Korea, I realized how little I knew about and how I was not well-traveled at all in many senses. So it's always relative, and you benefit from fully immersing yourself in another viewpoint.
Mm.
That's true all the time, I think, throughout one's life. And I think that learning can be lifelong in that respect. Very much that was what struck me when I looked at Precision. I realized that a lot of the terminology was alien to me, but I was willing to take on that challenge, which turned out not to be a mountain to climb, rather something that could be addressed gradually, and realized how transferable a lot of my know-how and skill set could be for the team that was already in place.
And in fact, you started off at Precision as an investor, you moved on to chair and then into the CEO slot. And just take me through that journey. I mean, there must have been, you know, it was sort of ever increasing kind of involvement, I guess, in the business. What was the point at which you said, yeah, you know what, this makes sense and I should be doing this?
Yeah, certainly. So it wasn't all intentional, but I
would encourage. Nothing in life ever is, but
nothing is. But I would encourage, I think, anyone listening to consider if there are parallels that might turn up in your life at a later stage, because I think this is not too strange and could happen. I started as an investor because I was introduced to Precision by one of the academics and scientists who started it. There were three of them. Professor Sir Magdi Yacoub, who is my godfather in Egypt, where he runs a charitable foundation. He's a very famous semi-retired heart surgeon. Mm. And so I was introduced to the company in order to help guide it and to help enlist the CEO and take it through its initial stages. We did find a CEO, or rather, they had found a candidate who I thought was certainly fine, and we started work. They encouraged me to be more and more involved and to give some guidance on the structure and initial steps that led me into the position of chairman of the company. But as you well know, when you're non-executive, you tend to look at things from a bit of a distance and place a certain, especially when it's a business that is not your background, place a certain level of trust in that everything will go according to clockwork. Nothing ever does. As it stands, Precision, being in a very novel space and being an implant, as I mentioned, and going to the U.S. market, but being U.K.-based and with the shift of cost of money since COVID, a lot of things, not just against Precision, but also unique to it, made fundraising more difficult. Mm. But also, I think, made the team realize more and more where the gaps were. Mm-hmm. So working very closely with the CEO at the time, we agreed that it would make sense for me to roll up sleeves more and more, become executive chairman, which mm-hmm. meant more focus on the business. And then at about summer last year, midsummer, we decided that it would make more sense for me to step in mm-hmm. and be really the face of the company as it goes through its proper, you know, aiming to get traction with investors, fundraising process, while the CEO at the time moved into an operational role, caring more for the day-to-day. So that was the progression. I think subconsciously what was going on was that I was also preparing myself more and more to understand where the different parts of the business fit together. And it was only when I felt prepared that naturally that led to the discussion with the CEO then.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it was that path.
Yeah. No, look, I mean, it makes a lot of sense. And it's really interesting, you know, going back to what you said about immersing yourself and not letting the biases from one side of the table impact, you know, your decisions on the other. I think one of the, you know, debates that is constantly had, certainly here in the UK and Europe, because we have fewer of them, is, you know, a lot of the VCs don't come from an operator background. They come from a finance background or pure finance background. Whereas in the US, you have a bit more of a balance of operators as well as finance driven VCs. And I think what's really interesting to me is, you know, that, and again, maybe this is a function of social media and Twitter, X, whatever you want to call it, you know, everything becomes very binary and it's like, no, you know, operator VCs are better. No, finance driven VCs are better. Again, to your point, it's probably a combination of both, right? Like having some of, you know, having some sensitivity to the operating side of the table allows you to understand what a founder's pathway is, what they're going through at the moment, but having the finance lens obviously is going to drive for commercial returns, which, you know, some founders, not all founders certainly, but some founders get so caught up in the product and what it is that they're building and the process of building a startup that they forget about actually the ultimate goal is commercialization and returns to investors and LPs on their side as well. So I think it's really interesting that your journey was a progression rather than a step, right? Like as in you didn't go from investor into the CEO slot. You proved yourself, I guess, out and to yourself that you're able to do it through working as chair, non-exec chair, exec chair, and then into the CEO slot. And obviously, I guess, you know, what I would assume is the skills that you bring to the table were ones that were needed by the business. And by the time that you took on the CEO role, to your point, you'd climbed that sort of mountain of knowledge and understood exactly, you know, what the business needed and how to drive it forward. And I think, I mean, the final thing I'll say, you know, the fact that you mentioned the CEO then moved into the operational role. In a small startup, especially, I think it's really hard or really difficult, especially for sort of visionary founders, if I can put it that way, or sales-driven founders, to both be sales-driven as well as operational, right? And in a business where you are creating both hardware and software, it is essential that the operational side is taken care of, right? I mean, talk me through some of the complexities sort of on that side, because presumably, you know, I mean, it's in the name, precision cardiovascular. The devices that you are building must require a huge amount of operational skill.
Yeah, that's right. So you're absolutely correct that operational and strategy, that's the struggle that everyone has on a daily basis. So this is what keeps me up at night, keeps others up at night. Mm. But that's part of what you need to do when running a company. And you don't need to necessarily be making jarring compromises. Mm. I'll give you an example here. So Precision, what they're doing is addressing an aspect of cardiovascular disease called heart failure, which is about 2% of any population. Now, there is a device in the U.S. market already that offers the same service that we are offering, and there are a couple of others in clinical trials. So we're following what's known as a predicate path, most likely in the U.S. for that. So on the one hand, the finance vision, finance-led VC or investor view, is show me how much more you can address the unmet need versus what exists in the market today, and try and correlate that with your market entry point so that I can, engineer out of that where the value is.
You can back calculate, essentially, reverse engineer where it's.
And that's a sensible approach, and it is needed. The other is to look at right time, right place. If the industry is moving towards a more proactive space where clinicians will appreciate way, way beyond the era of telehealth, rather having something that is co-therapeutic, allowing them to amend therapy for their individual patients, even on a daily basis, then perhaps we should not just be looking at what's in the market today. Perhaps we should be looking at the promise, at the dream. This is how high is your ceiling, at the data aspect beyond the infrastructure. If the data aspect becomes so important and so crucial and becomes part of standard care in the coming years, then perhaps it's not just our own infrastructure. It's rather any data coming out, how it can be parsed, analyzed, and interpreted for triaging and proactive management of patients. So perhaps Precision becomes more and more data-centric than even is the case today. That's more of the strategy approach. How are we applying that on a daily basis? So, for example, right now we're approaching the U.S. market. We're working with a U.S. regulatory consultant. Mm. We're taking two approaches. One is the standard one, which you have to do, which is to figure out your regulatory identity. Are you going to be a Class 3 implant and need a pre-market authorization? Could you, because of what's already been in the market, have a 510K approval or clearance, rather? Or could you be de novo if everything is completely different? This is something that you have to do, an exercise that you have to conduct through a pre-submission with the FDA. But there's something you can apply for, which we're doing, which is the breakthrough device program designation. And that is for the creme de la creme. And it's competitive, of course, very difficult to get. But the right time to consider that is now, when you can change things before you've frozen your design, when you can bring in testimonials from practitioners and show evidence, even at this early stage, that the promise is there 5, 6, 7 years from now to build now what will serve for where the industry is inevitably headed. So that way we're able to, in this regulatory space with the FDA, look to address both the necessary, which is the regulatory identity, as well as aim to understand better with concrete steps what the potential could be.
Yeah, I mean, amazing. I mean, in the realm of deep tech and medical devices, translating cutting-edge technology into market-ready products presents a unique set of challenges, let's say, from research and development to regulatory approval, as you just discussed. So can you share your insights on how you navigate these complexities, particularly in securing funding and partnerships that support the journey from concept to commercialization? And I guess it's worth saying that you recently received an Innovate UK grant. So it would be, congratulations, I guess, first off the bat, but it'd be great to understand the complexities around that and what went into securing that. But yeah, I mean, just at that broader level, securing funding for R&D heavy businesses, which are potentially 7-10 years away from commercialization, feels like, you know, there's a narrow set of investors, or certainly there has been a narrow set of investors. It feels like that's changing a little bit at the moment as well. But yeah, I'd love to get your perspective.
Sure. By no means it's black or white, but I'll perhaps share a bit of my experience. I think, first of all, the world of R&D is a different world to the business world and will remain so. And probably that's a good thing in many ways. But if you want to commercialize, you need to bridge the two worlds. I'm still stating the obvious here, but the point that I will I would like to make here is that it's not enough to show that you have an expert team for this stage. What's more important is to show that the partners that you would work with are partners that are trusted, are scalable, and are best in class for what they do, so that your message in the business world is not diluted. It's all well and good to have the two preeminent authorities in one particular technology, but that's not the same as saying that you have a range of partners who can work well with you, will not fall behind, can be monitored well, and who have exceptional pedigree, the same as yourselves. So showing that you have an extended team that can be trusted is paramount. And I think that's one of the critical things in raising funds, is to convey to investors that although they're looking at a small team, the extended team is just as
Because essentially, again, when an investor is looking at any business, one of the first things they look at is the team, right? And with a business like Precision Cardiovascular, you'll have a small team in a breakthrough technology or in a very, very critical kind of technology. And small teams, unless they have, you know, incredibly, strong advisors or board members or others from within the team that have those connections, et cetera, you know, can be hard to convince, I guess, investors that actually, yeah, we're the right team now to do it. But to your point, if you have those sort of partnerships in place, if you can show that you are playing in the same pond as the big boys, I guess, right? You're able to sort of not rely on that trust, but you're able to kind of pass through that trust or benefit from that trust that, okay, they're working with these guys know what they're doing, therefore, okay, there's a tick in that box and we can move forward to the next stage, right?
Yeah, I would characterize regulated businesses such as ours as being just conveying to investors that you can deliver on budget, on time. Mm. That's one part of it. You then need to look at what happens when you're in market. And the big, for me, an insight, I hope it is for others, is look at what you're trying to do as a disruption in terms of the benefit it offers, but make it easy for the gatekeepers. So we have a multi-stakeholder model. There's the doctor, heart failure specialist, there's the patient, and there's the payer, the hospital. So you need to be low cost enough for the insurance company or hospital. You need to be unobtrusive and easy and low in compliance for the patient. But for the doctor, the heart failure specialist, you don't want to make their life difficult by telling them use this proprietary workstation. So your channel fit is also really important. So look to engage early on with whatever systems exist and make sure that you can show the doctors or your stakeholders that you'll be able to seamlessly fit into their daily workflow. I think that's really important for R&D. So you can have partners before you're in market who aren't scalable all the way to market, but are just able to help you through those milestones. Once you're in market, you need to go to the standard systems that exist in order to showcase your technology at its best form and ensure best acceptance.
Yeah, this is a really interesting point for me because, again, drawing the parallel from sort of the education space, you have this unique situation with these sort of businesses and these sort of industries where your user of your technology is not the economic buyer. Mm-hmm. And your user of the technology, to use your phrase, has gatekeepers above it. So in the case of Precision, the gatekeeper is the doctor, the economic buyer is the hospital or the insurance, but the user ultimately is the patient, right? So you've got to convince a doctor that, yeah, this is going to fit seamlessly into how you work already. And, you know, using our technology is not going to disrupt your life. You're not going to have to learn a whole bunch of new stuff. You might have to learn some new stuff, fine. They've then got to convince the patient that, yeah, okay, this technology is worth you using for X, Y, Z reason. And separately, I mean, like, I guess this happens sort of contemporaneously. Precision will probably have to have convinced the hospital, the insurers, that yes, this is a technology that you should pay for because it fits with X, Y, Z. And actually, for an insurer, as an example, it will hopefully reduce your potential future claims because we're able to proactively manage the condition as opposed to, you know, waiting until something happens and then, you know, you're essentially having to pay large, especially in the US, large sums of money as that progressively gets worse. And of course, from an insurer's perspective, once a patient or once an individual starts going down the track of having had some sort of medical issue, premiums go up, but they also know that, yeah, the premiums go up because we know we're gonna have to pay more. And ultimately, yeah, there's a high level of chance that obviously that patient's, not to get morbid, but that patient's longevity may have been reduced and therefore their ability to extract premiums over the longer term reduces. So actually for them, it's very much a case, okay, if this technology can actually extend life, extend healthy life, then actually for them, it makes a huge amount of sense, right?
Yeah, and there's something I'm going to mention in a second that's additional as a tip for any R&D business, I think. But I would also add that in a value-based system, you can come up with other ways of portraying benefits. So in our case, a single hospitalization prevented recoups the entire cost of implantation.
Exactly.
There's various ways you can look at it.
Yeah.
But the other aspect I wanted to bring up is fundraising nowadays is different to what it was
3 years ago.
Yes, of course. And also the way you present yourself now. I mean, I know I only spend a minute or two at most on a deck. But funnily enough, when you're designing a deck as a founder,
you spend hours.
You spend hours and you expect hours to be spent. So, of course, the advice going around nowadays is really reduce the word count, etc. But also, why don't you, in advance, write out what could serve as an investment memo for the institutional investor?
It's hilarious.
Make life easy.
Actually, we were talking about Jamie Harford earlier, who introduced us. I literally, on one of the groups that we're on together, literally said, you know, my preference is a very, very small check angel, so I can't really dictate to founders to do this. But, you know, long form memo actually 10x is a deck from an investor's perspective, because the deck essentially is just an eye catcher to get you in the door. But the memo tells you what the business is, how you're thinking about the business, and acts as a launch point for when you then have a conversation, because you've already got much more detail than you would have got from a deck. So yeah, I mean, I'm massive firm believer in
that. And of course, it helps out the institutional investor because you've already done part
of
the
work.
And probably you, I wouldn't say control the narrative, maybe you do, but you avoid misconceptions.
Yeah.
But then I have a more specific tip for R&D businesses, which is that, have you looked at your competitive landscape in terms of complementarity as well?
Mm-hmm.
It's important to do this for R&D businesses because the world is murkier than one imagines it to be. In our space, we only have maybe 2-3 straight-up competitors. But for an investor looking at us, in their portfolio, they may say, hang on, have I already invested in something that looks competitive to this?
Mm.
I think I'll pass.
Mm.
You need to clarify early on and study it in order to clarify where there's something that's actually complementary to you, not competitive,
mm-hmm.
because it can be misinterpreted that way.
Mm.
And that requires you to really take a different viewpoint on your business. For example, for us, we work outside of hospitals.
Mm-hmm.
There's a suite of tools and startups, very innovative, that work inside hospitals for the same conditions.
Mm-hmm.
To an outside investor, they may look like one and the same. It's important to clarify that. So complementarity is just as important as competition in order to show what the landscape looks like and how it's developing. That's very much appreciated by investors.
And I mean, I guess actually it works in your favor because a complementary product means that you have an entry point, right? Or an exit point, I guess, as well, in terms of the market, right? So if you have a complementary product that works earlier in the life cycle than yours, then obviously there's a transition into your product thereafter. And again, if there's another product further down the pipe, then, you know, yours can act as the entry point into that. That's super, super interesting. And then just talk us through the sort of Innovate UK grant. I mean, so I think you were able to secure 400,000 from the Innovate UK grant. How was the process? How did you find that? What were the challenges?
Right. So it was challenging, certainly.
Yeah.
I think it's a third time lucky for us. if I'm not mistaken. So, and I think that's true of many businesses, maybe even more than that. It's extremely competitive. What we've realized is a few things. One is that it's important to try and choose as much as possible what suits you. So just like you aim to choose an investor that's targeted, similarly for grants, you should look to dedicate your effort where you're most suited to a particular grant. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that can change over time. It's not every day that a grant is open for applications, but it's your time and effort, so that's a consideration. The second thing is that we're not grant writers. Mm. We're business people, scientists, so there is a benefit to, just like you might get a copywriter for a white paper, final gloss, or something like that. Also, grant writers can offer fantastic services. We're using a regulatory consultant with the FDA, as I mentioned, at this early stage. I think don't shy away from grant writers. Grant consultants. It's important that you write because that really showcases what you're doing better, and that really is demonstrated. But the grant consultant can really offer invaluable expertise there. The third thing is be prepared for certain, and this is development independent of Precision, some grants are reviewed by very few assessors. Mm-hmm. Some are reviewed by many more. Mm-hmm. It's in your benefit to aim for grants that are reviewed by many more assessors because it just smooths out the interpretations.
And biases that may be brought. Yes.
So, and I think Innovate UK is moving towards that. In fact, the award of Biomedical Catalyst was delayed by a total of 20 days, I think, because they had five assessors rather than the originally disclosed three assessors per per project or per application. So three is good, four is better, five is obviously much better. So so that's something to take into account, that it works in your favor. Also consider what you're aiming for. So we aimed for a smaller amount versus the maximum project size, which is five times that, 2.5 million, for reasons that we believed that we could control better in our written application than we could for the larger investments. Yeah. Larger investments require an interview panel, which of course we were happy to prepare for, but you just add more uncertainty into it. For
well, you us, also have to find, you have to be able to justify how that, how it's going to be spent, right?
Of course.
And 2.5, unless you're spending it all in the first 12 months, the likelihood of you having full clarity on where that cash is going to be spent is, diminished.
Of course. And we took a view, and I was an active proponent of it, that the huge benefit of a grant is not so much the funding. Of course, the funding is very welcome, but the validation.
Yeah.
So this is different to a commercial investment where you can put out the press release. You can explain the competitive nature of it because that's publicized. You can show the assessors and the multidisciplinary background that they have as well, respectively. You can, obviously, this is UK taxpayer funding, so it's very, very closely scrutinized on an ongoing basis.
Yep.
And that's different to a lot of early stage angel or high net worth investment where you do a bit of diligence up front, but then you leave it to the institutional investor later to monitor. This is different. So the validation elements there play very, very well with a fundraising process that you're simultaneously undertaking with VCs and family offices.
Yeah.
So I think the validation element is huge.
Amazing.
Yeah.
One final question. So as CEO of a pre-commercialized medical device business like Precision, beyond keeping a constant eye on cash flow, which I don't think there's a single founder out there that doesn't, what are the things that keep you up at night?
Right. So funnily enough, what dominates Precision for me is not so much its pre-commercialization nature, but rather the fact that it's a small team.
Mm-hmm.
So in a small team, you just have to do all sorts of different jobs and tasks. And that's not to everyone's liking. So motivating and guiding and encouraging is a huge part of what keeps me up at night. I'm in between the UK and Egypt, so I'm constantly back and forth using face-to-face where needed to make sure that we're all aligned and all on the same page and able to dip in and out of different activities as needed. It's very, very dynamic. So in that sense, we're almost like any other business that is even non-tech in the sense that we're small and looking to scale and therefore needing to wear many hats at once. Myself, I'm an investor as well as a CEO in Precision. So I have huge vested interest, but I also have to consider different viewpoints. The same is true for every team member. So, you know, our scientific director, research director, clinical director, they all are, you know, I actively encourage them to do different things that are needed and to be very malleable. And that is my main focus day in, day out.
Amazing. So it's been an absolute pleasure having you here in the studio with me today, Mohammed. For our audience, where's the best place for them to find you online? You're on LinkedIn, you're on Twitter. Where can they find you?
Yeah, so our website is precision-cv.com. And you'll find us by searching on LinkedIn Precision Cardiovascular. We've relaunched the website and we have a social media campaign going out on LinkedIn, which includes the grant as well as further posts delving into the world of heart failure and proactive medicine. So I'd encourage the audience to engage with us that way.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining me today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you, Alex.